everybody. Are the modules working? Are they working okay? All right. Not sure what happened there, but they're working. Okay. I'm going to try to wrap it up today. What I'm going to do is try to bring things together a little bit to try to show you how I was hoping it would all fit together for the kidney. So as we talked about, this is sort of where we started for me to tell you how it was that the kidney gets what it gets. Remember, lots of cardiac output, lots of blood flow to the kidney, 20%. And then a fair amount, 180 liters a day, but only 20% of 20% goes into the Bowman space. And then we learned about all the transport that happens in all the different parts of the kidney with different permeabilities and different properties. And we made, you know, some interesting, these are the numbers that came out. So I want to sort of, you know, take a little overview again and then drill down a little bit. So this is where we started with the glomerulus. And one thing I wanted to point out that we didn't really say is that there's differences between the blood flow in the cortex and the medulla. The cortex, where all the glomeruli live, gets most of the blood flow. And of course, as you go down into the medulla, there's less and less blood flow. What that means, of course, is when blood flow to the kidney gets compromised, the part of the kidney that dies first is down here because it lives on the edge of hypoxia. So the PO2 in the inner medulla can be like 20. And so it doesn't take much to tip people over from hypoxic or ischemic injury. And that's why much of the acute kidney injury that we see in the hospital is due to compromised blood flow. The cortex gets most of the blood flow. That's where the glomeruli are. Now, here what I wanted to just to say in terms of something just to review a little bit, this is the oral fentanyl loop of Henle. We talked about the loop being electropositive to drive certain cations across. So I wanted to show you another picture of the same kind of thing. This is a picture taken from the New England Journal of Medicine. And you see here we have the thick ascending limb being blown up here. And what you see in this particular cartoon, which is trying to illustrate certain disorders, I did mention very briefly Barger syndrome. Barger syndrome is a genetic disease. And the genetic disease, interestingly, is all of Barger syndrome is due to genetic defects in transport in the thick ascending limb. And the different types of Barger syndrome are just due to whichever protein has got the problem. So what you see here, of course, the first one we discovered was defects in this transporter, and so it was named type 1. But as you see, as we went on, we were able to find people that have defects of every single transport element on both sides of the membrane. The bottom line is that all people with Barger syndrome have decreased transport in the thick ascending limb. The question is specifically to the family, which protein is their problem. But what this slide also shows is, again, the electropositive voltage and then showing you the permeability pathway paracellin, which is between the cells, which is necessary for calcium and magnesium and, to some extent, other cations to be reabsorbed. So this is just another picture of the same thing with a little bit more detail. And next year we'll talk about the genetic disorders of transport. But this gives you another look at the same thing. So both of those cell models are showing the same thing in slightly different ways. So if you then take a zoom out and we look at the whole nephron again, here again we got the proximal tubule, the thin descending limb, the thin ascending limb, of course no water permeability as soon as you turn the loop, then the thick ascending limb, the macula, and after the macula densa, it becomes the distal convoluted tubule or the early DCT. Then there's a connecting tubule and then a collecting duct that is cortical and medullary. So each part of the nephron knows how to reabsorb sodium. So going to the proximal tubule early on, you see that the sodium proton exchanger is the main apical transport pathway. Of course, the energy provided by the pump in the back. And then what happens, we talked about two important things happening here. Sodium reabsorption. And that sodium reabsorption is also coupled to other goodies being reabsorbed, like glucose and amino acids and phosphate, and the fact that this is a major pathway for reclaiming the filtered bicarbonate. And what we said was It shows here that it's easy to get a proton from water, and that this shows how a proton from water can be secreted, and by secreting that proton, a bicarbonate is reabsorbed using the sodium bicarbonate cotransporter with the stoichiometry as one sodium and three bicarbonates. And these reactions are catalyzed by isoforms of carbonic anhydrase. We'll learn about inhibitors of those next year. But that's sodium transport in the early proximal tubule. Then when you get to the thick ascending limb, it's the same thing I just showed you on the last slide, the triple transporter called NKCC2, the ROMK potassium channel with this recycling, and again, the energy being provided by the pump. There is some amount of proton secretion in this segment as well, where about 10 or 15% of the bicarbonate, remember that 80% of bicarbonate gets reabsorbed here. There's still some to continue to be reabsorbed. Some of that happens here, again, through proton secretion. Then if you go to the distal nephron, here's where the thiazide-sensitive co-transporter, NCC, which is blocked by thiazides, is this sodium chloride co-transporter. You see the two important things, that positive voltage in the thick ascending limb has now become a negative voltage as you go from the thick ascending limb to the distal convoluted tubule. And all of a sudden, water can't, it's a water impermeant. So this, we still have the water impermeance that began here is still going on here because we haven't entered the part of the nephron yet that's sensitive to ADH. So ADH has the conditional water permeability, but from here, the green, the yellow, and all the way through, even into the blue, water still can't get in. Finally, you come to the collecting duct where we have sodium reabsorption via ENaC, potassium secretion via ROMK. That negative lumen continues because we're trying to secrete potassium and acid. This diagram does not show the intercalated cell, which is the next cell over, which is giving us the proton secretion. And I'll show you that. But this is, again, sodium reabsorption throughout the nephron. Different transporters doing more than one thing at a time, and each transporter makes physiological sense of why it should be doing that. And it makes sense, you should start to see why it makes sense that the lumen of the thick ascending limb is positive to drive the positive charges across, and the lumen of the more distal nephron becomes negative to facilitate secretion of potassium and protons. So we have a clicker question here. And you know, you may or may not have your clickers. It doesn't matter. We can do it by hands or by clickers. But let me tell you what the question is. You have a substance N, and I'm going to tell you a couple things about that substance. First of all, it's freely filtered across the glomerulus. And when I say freely filtered, what does that mean? What does freely filtered mean? Right. The concentration in Bowman space is the same as the concentration in the plasma. That means it must have been freely filtered. Okay, and I'm telling you it's freely filtered at 1,800 micrograms a minute. The second piece of information you get is 2/3 of the filtered load is reabsorbed along the proximal tubule. 400 micrograms per minute is reabsorbed in the thick ascending limb. 100 is reabsorbed in the early distal tubule. And 82 is reabsorbed along the collecting duct. Your question is, what percent of the filtered load is excreted? See if I can find that thing you do. I don't know if I have the thingy. May not matter. I should be good. They have a built-in. Anyway. I don't know, 5. Open polling? Okay. So what percent of the filtered load is excreted? Okay, good. So we got, 30? That's good. 35. That's good. All right, let's see what people are thinking. They're thinking 58% said answer C. And that's quite good because that is the correct answer. And let's see how we do this problem. So to do this problem, you just have to remember that excretion is our master equation. Your excretion is filtered minus reabsorbed plus secretion. So this is the amount that was filtered. Reabsorption is the 1,200, that's two-thirds in the proximal tubule. So it's 1,800 because it's easy to figure out what two-thirds of 1,800 is, 1,200. Plus the 400 in the thick ascending limb, plus the 100 in the distal tubule, plus the 82 in the collecting duct, and nothing is secreted, so that's 18. And 18 is 1% of 1,800. So 1% of the filtered load is excreted. So what is this substance similar to? It's similar to sodium. 67% reabsorbed along the proximal tubule, 22% reabsorbed in the thick ascending limb, 5% reabsorbed in the early distal tubule by these transporters, and finally the last few percentage reabsorbed in the collecting duct by ENaC. So different transporters reabsorbing sodium, and obviously I picked substance N to be similar to sodium to illustrate this is probably pretty much what happens to sodium. And 99% of the sodium gets reabsorbed often, meaning that 1% is filtered. 1% of the filtered load is excreted. So any questions on that before we go to the next question? Good? Okay. Clicker question number 2, substance K. I wonder what that's similar to. Is freely filtered across the glomerulus at 60 micrograms per minute. Two-thirds of the filtered load is reabsorbed along the proximal tubule, then another 15 in the thick ascending limb, and then 115 micrograms per minute is secreted along the collecting duct. The question is, how much substance K is excreted per minute? Oh, sorry. Change that. Five answers. Stop. Five answers. Okay. So you have to keep changing that every time? We hit the magical 40. And answer E is by far the winner. And that's good because that is correct. So again, to do this one, use the same exact equation. You're told that 60 are filtered. You're told that 40 are reabsorbed, two-thirds are reabsorbed in the proximal tubule, then another 15. And then along the collecting duct, along the distal nephron, 115 are secreted. So this math would give you 60 minus 55 is 5. 5 plus 115 is 120. So substance K is similar to potassium, where you see that the amount secreted is more than the filtered load. In fact, by the numbers, twice as much comes out in the excretion as filtered. And this was actually the first evidence that the kidney, when people discovered this, that the amount of potassium that was excreted in the final urine was higher than the amount that could be filtered. All of a sudden, that was actually the first evidence that the kidney was actually secreting. So it was behavior of potassium looking like this that led people to say, oh, the kidney must know how to do this. And that's how secretion was discovered and proved. And in fact, almost all of the filtered potassium is reabsorbed before you get to the distal nephron. And almost everything that comes out in the urine is a result of secretion in the more distal nephron along the collecting duct. And this occurs mostly via ROM-K. There's another channel I didn't mention called the Maxi-K channel, which is a flow-activated potassium channel. It's a detail. But suffice to say that secretion of potassium is all channel-mediated, mostly through ROM-K.
Okay.
No. No. So in the proximal tubule, most things that are filtered get reabsorbed 67% of the filtered load. That's kind of just what happens. It turns out that to stay in potassium homeostasis, it's really the job of the distal nephron to do that. So in fact, the amount of potassium that you have to secrete, things don't really happen until the distal nephron. And so it's not because of in the proximal tubule, there's a need for isotonic solution reabsorption, and that contributes to part of it. But potassium is being used for different things. So sometimes that potassium is being used to drive transport in the thick ascending limb through that recycling, and that's because we're going to use it until we need to get rid of it. And then the distal nephron specializes in that. And that's why in the old days, when cave people ate 400 millimoles of potassium a day, way more than we eat today, 80 or 100 we eat today, the distal nephron needed to get busy learning how to secrete potassium. And even for them, they reabsorbed other filtered potassium and then secreted it all. Okay, so here's a question. A person who eats a typical Western diet and weighs 60 kilograms has a plasma bicarbonate of 24 and a GFR of 172 liters a day. We're asked how many millimoles of protons must be secreted along the renal tubule for this person to stay in acid-base balance. So at first you look at that question, well, that's hard. I think that's impossible to figure out. That should be your first reaction. That looks impossible. So when you are taking a test and your first reaction is, well, that looks impossible, the first thing you should do is figure out if there's anything to calculate, because that will give you time to have your mind be busy with something else instead of panicking. So I always look for something to calculate. So I'm thinking, oh, I don't know. Let's see. Well, maybe it's a good idea to first calculate the filtered load of bicarbonate. Well, that's pretty easy. Since it's 24 millimoles per liter and the GFR is 172.5 liters a day, that's just multiplication, and I can do that. 4,140 millimoles of bicarbonate are filtered. Now, I know I can't lose any of that because I can't. I'm trying to prevent acidosis. Losing bicarbonate is not a good strategy, so I'm going to reabsorb all of that. And all of that filtered bicarbonate must be reabsorbed via what we've called proton secretion. The bringing back into the body of bicarbonate that's filtered is called bicarbonate reclamation. We're reclaiming the bicarbonate that we filtered that we don't want to lose. We're reclaiming that. Okay? And so all of that is going to be reclaimed. Now, that's not going to be enough because this person's eating a Western diet. And as I once mentioned to you, or maybe several times said, the typical person on the typical Western diet produces about 1 millimole of proton per kilogram per day. Well, you know how many kilograms the person weighs, so their acid load per day from the food they're eating is 60 millimoles of proton. So each of these protons consumes a bicarbonate when it comes into the body. So you got to get rid of all those protons. And this is not reclamation so much. It's called regeneration. Because here we're reclaiming the filtered bicarbonate. Here we're actually regenerating the bicarbonate that was taken out by a proton that was added to our body. So this is called bicarbonate regeneration. So if you add this up, 4140 plus 60 is a total of 4200 millimoles of proton per day. So that's 4.2 moles of proton per day must be secreted. So who does this? Well, most of it, is the reclamation process. 80%, or 3,312, would be done by the proximal tubule. 621 would be done by the thick ascending limb, and 207 would be done by the collecting duct. So that's how we reclaim these ones. Then we have to regenerate the bicarbonate that's been consumed, and all 60 millimoles are going to be regenerated by the proton pump in the alpha intercalated cell of the collecting duct. So the way this is going to kind of look and work is, here's the net acid excretion equation. Here's 80% of that filtered bicarbonate being reabsorbed in the proximal tubule, 15% in the thick ascending limb, and then along the collecting duct, the last 5%, all by proton secretion. All by proton secretion. And where do those protons have to go? They have to go, and I'll show you where they have to go. So for the reclamation of the filtered bicarbonate, this is that same picture that I've shown you. These bicarbonates are being filtered. Each one of these protons gets secreted, and that reclaims the filtered bicarbonate. So the proximal tubule reclaims filtered bicarbonate through the process that we've gone over a number of times. Proton, secrete a proton, reabsorb bicarbonate, and you have that animation that I gave you. That's proximally, and that's the motif of how it's done for all filtered bicarbonate. Then, for the regeneration, here's the alpha intercalated cell. And the alpha intercalated cell has two choices. Those protons need to be secreted by the proton ATPase, and then there's two different receivers. So-called titratable acid, most of which is phosphate, but some of which could be sulfate, are your titratable acids. And then the regulatable catchers, or urinary buffers, the ammonia, which can be revved up. And we went over this, as you might remember this slide, where we said normally this is kind of the way the load is filtered. This is the way the usual proton load is excreted. 22 of the 67 here, 65 here on titratable acid, 43 on ammonia. But if you all of a sudden acid load a person and give them lots of acid, way more than they might eat, or if they have diarrhea and lose a lot of bicarbonate, because that's the equivalent. Losing bicarbonate and diarrhea and being acid loaded with protons, the same thing from an acid base point of view. Well, again, you see titratable acid doesn't do much. It's the ammonium that does is upregulated to be able to handle what needs to happen to be able to excrete all that additional acid. So in these last few slides, we basically recapitulated everything the kidney does. Here's the way you know you're getting it. If this looked like review to you, you're getting it. If it didn't look like review to you, review it. Because this is it. Okay, so before we drill down deeper, I want to say, does that make sense to people? Yeah?
I wanted to ask a question about when you said the amount secreted is more than filtered load.
Yeah, for potassium. Well, I mean, again, when filtered means coming across the glomerulus. Secreted means coming from the blood and going into the urine. So there's two ways, there's at least two ways for something to get into the urine. Get filtered into the tubule and stay there. Or get filtered or not get filtered, but get secreted. So that very first, you know, our very first big slide of how things can get into in and out of the tubule. So that's what I'm saying. Since we knew we measured more potassium in the urine than we knew had gotten filtered, how did it get there? It got there without being filtered. It got there by secretion directly from the tubule, directly from the blood into the tubule. That's secretion. And that's what the collecting duct does. Secretes potassium. Yeah. Okay. So here's where we sort of stopped last time with the, you know, introduce you back to the glomerulus, which again, Dr. Gibson wants you to remember is a three-dimensional object that can be cut an infinite number of ways with an afferent and efferent arteriole. And I want to talk a little bit more about GFR and the regulation of GFR. So as we've mentioned, each kidney, you're born with hopefully somewhere around 1 million nephrons per kidney. People born with less nephrons are more likely to have hypertension. But the glomerulus is very special because it's a capillary, a special capillary, that's between two arterioles. And the afferent arterioles take blood towards the glomerulus, and the afferent arteriole can be constricted by certain things that are in your body, like adenosine, or drugs that people can take, like nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. Constricting the afferent arteriole is going to tend to decrease GFR, all other things being equal, because it's on the afferent side of the glomerulus. On the other hand, the efferent arterioles take blood away from the glomerulus and can be constricted by angiotensin II. When you constrict the arteriole on the other side of the glomerulus, that will increase GFR. So medications we give people like ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers will tend to undo this a little bit, dilate the efferent arteriole, and therefore will tend to decrease GFR. So if somebody says to you, I've constricted a blood vessel near the glomerulus, did I increase or decrease GFR? Do you have enough information to answer that question? No. You need to know which side of the glomerulus are you on. Okay? So now if I tell you, I increased GFR, what did I do? Did I do something to the afferent, the efferent, or either? Either. What could I have done to the afferent to increase GFR? Dilate it. What could I have done to the efferent to increase GFR? There you go. So, and the glomerulus is the part that gets sick in chronic kidney disease. So let's look at this. So just to show you that here's a glomerulus sitting in a Bowman space. Here's a glomerulus that So I dissected out this nephron from a kidney, and I just made a little cut, and the glomerulus just pops right up. I mean, the glomerulus just sort of, it's literally just being held in Bowman space, not by anything in particular. So if you take the nephron out, the glomerulus will just pop out of Bowman space. Beautiful Bowman's capsule, beautiful nephron, beautiful glomerulus. Okay, so both sides of glomerulus. From the inside is this fenestrated endothelium, and on the outside are these slits of the podocytes coming down and having their foot processes invest themselves all over the capillary to look like these slits. Okay, so this is from the inside of the blood vessel, the inside of the capillary. This is from the outside. Okay, so this is, if you're here, you're full of blood. If you're here, you're full of urine. Okay, this is the urine side, that's the blood side. Okay, now, if you take a cut through that, an EM cut through that, this is a classic picture from 1961. Marilyn Farquhar and George Pilotti were at Yale. They were married. He won the Nobel Prize. He won the Nobel Prize for doing unbelievable electron microscopy. He couldn't have won the Nobel Prize without her because Marilyn was his wife and also an outstanding EM technician. So they worked together. So I'm sure that they put the Nobel Prize in the middle of the bed. But in any case, if you take this, this was one of the first great pictures we had that showed exactly this cartoon, that you've got the blood on the capillary side, these endothelial cells here, then you've got this beautiful basement membrane, and on the other side you have these processes that are coming down and separated by something. There's definitely area between these foot processes. Let's look at what's going on in that region. So this is a beautiful picture from the New England Journal of Medicine by an article by Trygvesson. Trygvesson, very nice guy. Trygvesson is the guy who figured out that I mentioned it once in class, the nephrotic syndrome that was seen in Finland in kids, the congenital nephrotic syndrome of the Finnish variant, the Finnish variety of congenital nephrotic syndrome. All these kids in Finland being born with huge proteinuria, and sometimes their kidneys have to be taken out to save their lives, so they're wasting so much protein. Well, Trygvesson and his group figured out what was wrong, and they figured out that they had a mutant protein called nephrin. Well, let me just show you this. Here's a picture of the kidneys as they sit anatomically. Now you take a little slice out of that, and here's a showing you the glomerulus with the afferent and the efferent arteriole and the beautiful glomerulus in Bowman space. Then you take a piece of that capillary, and you see the podocytes with their foot processes and the slits. Okay? And then here's our little sandwich. The red fenestrated endothelial cell, the purple basement membrane, and then the foot processes. Now you take a piece of that. Okay? This should be red because it should be bloody. But here's the endothelium, which is the capillary part, the blood part. Blood cells would be here. Here's the glomerular basement membrane. And then here's these foot processes coming down. Now you see each foot process coming down. And there's all this stuff going on between the foot processes. These foot processes are talking to each other. They're interdigitating. And they're shaking hands with each other using homophilic interactions of nephrin. So nephrin is one of the proteins that bridges this. If you don't have working nephrin, this thing falls apart. And that's why those kids have terrible nephrotic syndrome. Their nephrin is mutant. So if you look in there, there's a zillion different proteins in there now, nephrin being one of them. But many causes, if there's anything wrong with any of the structures in here that lead to the disintegration of this integrity, you'll likely get proteinuria. Okay? So here it is again, nephrin sitting right here among other molecules. This is the cartoon. This is a real EM that shows, again, the same thing, endothelium, glomerular basement membrane. These little dots these arrows are pointing at little dots, are immunogold staining for the nephrin molecule, showing that nephrin is localized in between these foot processes. And that's the thing that's very important in order to make it work as a protein barrier. Yeah. Because these kids don't have kidney failure. These kids have a huge protein leak. So they're born and they need to grow and all the proteins in their body are leaking out through their kidneys. Their kidney function is okay. They don't have kidney failure, but the protein leak is killing them. Yeah. No. They have one problem and one problem only that's killing them. They're dying of malnutrition from protein loss. That's it. You fix that, it's So you take their kidneys out to, you have to take their kidneys out to fix it sometimes and give them a kidney transplant. But that's the main problem. The main problem is they have mutant nephrin. So again, the tubule's fine. So there would, you would not anticipate any problems with glucose. Glucose is freely filtered whether you have perfect nephrin or not. It's after the filtration that the glucose gets reabsorbed. Their only problem is in the glomerulus. Their tubules are perfect. And here it is again. Here you see a gigantic red blood cell, the endothelial cell, the basement membrane, and here you see this. Each one of these dots is a nephrin molecule. Beautiful. In these kids, you would see the, in these kids from Finland, you would see all these podocytes completely smushed together because it's all falling apart and proteins just leaking out like crazy, leaking across. So here's how the glomerulus works. The glomerulus works. There's two things that determine whether something's going to get filtered across the glomerulus. One of them you could predict. The bigger something is, the less likely it's going to get across. So here's a graph that shows you bigger things over here and smaller things over here. Big stuff doesn't get through so easily. It's less filtered. Okay? But even if something is a given size, there's another factor that determines whether it's filtered or not, and that's its charge. So things that are negatively charged get less filtered, okay? And things that are positively charged get filtered more easily. So take something that's about here, this size. Well, if it was, if it's negatively charged, almost none of it's filtered. If it's neutral, much more is filtered. And if it happens to be positively charged, it's way filtered. So this is all same size, but the charge makes the difference. So negative charges move the curve to the left. So things that aren't supposed to be filtered, like albumin, are big and negative. Big and negative. Okay? So albumin is somewhere like down here. Big and negative. Okay? Here's a table that shows you some of these things. Here's water, of course, being very easy. All these things where this ratio of filtrate to filtrand are one. This is the definition of freely filtered. So little things like water, urea, sugars, easily get across. Inulin, pretty much freely filtered. Okay? But now you start to get into the bigger things like serum albumin and hemoglobin. These are very big, and they're not really filtered. Okay, so the amount that gets across is very low because of its shape, its size, and its charge. Albumin is negatively charged and big. So that's why it shouldn't get across. But when these kids in Finland have the nephrin problem, everything's getting across, and it's bad. So let me show you what the physical forces that are driving filtration. Filtration occurs from this direction to this direction. So the filtration is always from the capillary lumen out to the urinary space. It never goes the other way. It's always this way, always up. And what determines the three factors that determine the GFR are the pressure gradient across the capillary. That makes sense. And that's a hydrostatic pressure, an oncotic pressure gradient across the capillary wall, and then how much surface that you have. Now, this makes sense from our very first talk together. We talked about transport takes two things, driving force and a permeability. These two things together make up the driving force, a pressure. This factor is the permeability factor, and that permeability factor of the capillary wall times how much surface there is to filter is what makes up this ultrafiltration constant. So the equation for GFR is this one. It looks scary, but it's actually pretty simple. It's got an integral sign in it, so that makes everybody scared. But all this is it says that the GFR, which is a flow rate, is determined by the product of two things. The net pressure across any piece of the glomerular capillary from the beginning to the end, the net driving force favoring filtration, times this factor. So the higher delta P is and the smaller delta pi is, the more pressure you're going to have. So to put this in cartoon form that's a little bit more friendly to look at, I give you this slide. So this slide shows you the two things in green are the two forces that favor filtration to occur. The pressure in the glomerular capillary, the hydrostatic pressure in the glomerular capillary, and whatever oncotic pressure happens to exist in Bowman's space. Both of those things favor filtration. Then there's two things that push the other way. What pushes the other way is any hydrostatic pressure that happens to be in Bowman space. And of course, the oncotic pressure in the glomerular capillary, which changes as fluid moves out. So there's this net force of ultrafiltration that is the sum of all these forces, where you have to consider the two forces that are helping filtration and the two forces that are opposing filtration. So on the next slide, you see this again here. Here are those pressures. So first of all, the oncotic pressure in Bowman space is negligible. So we can forget about that. Then what you have is a fairly constant hydrostatic force pressure in Bowman space. And then there's two other things. There's the high glomerular capillary pressure, which is pretty much maintained along the whole capillary. And then this is the only thing that's changing. So what you should notice here first is I see three lines that are pretty flat. That means three out of four of these are easy. One of them's flat and zero. Okay, now we're really dealing with three. Two flat lines and a line that's not flat. So all you have to do is say at any given point along the capillary, from the afferent arterial to the efferent, what do these pressures look like? And as long as the net pressure, that is this green line, is above the red line, filtration will occur. Filtration will occur for the distance that the green is bigger than the red. When these two come together, and this comes together because as fluid leaves the capillary, the oncotic pressure in the capillary goes up because fluid has left. And when enough fluid leaves that the oncotic pressure in the capillary is equal to the hydrostatic pressure, filtration will stop. So filtration occurs as long as filtration can occur. In other words, filtration occurs as long as there's a driving force for it to occur. Because there's always a permeability, and there's a net driving force until there isn't. So we could take three examples, and the next slide shows those three examples. Here's what happens normally. Normally, you're supposed to go the whole way down the capillary from afferent to efferent without them being equal. What does this mean? This means that at the normal plasma flow, they're never supposed to be equal. There's always supposed to be some net force favoring filtration. So you're filtering along your whole capillary. Well, that's why you made a whole capillary, to filter along the whole capillary. You didn't make a capillary to use just a piece of it. And that's why when pressures drop or things aren't normal, if all of a sudden this happens earlier along the capillary that they meet, you're basically wasting the rest of the capillary. Because there's a filtration surface you're not using. This is not where we live. Here's where we live. Okay? And the reason that there's autoregulation of glomerular filtration rate is because it autoregulates to stay here. The whole point of autoregulation is stay here. Not here, not here. This is Goldilocks. This is too small. This is too big. This is just right. Yep.
Why is the lowest
capital oncotic pressure about zero? Because Bowman space is, if you look at what's in Bowman space, the oncotic pressure in Bowman space, oncotic pressure being mostly determined by protein. Bowman space is a protein-free ultrafiltrate. So an ultrafiltrate with no proteins in it, there's a zillion ions in it. But that's not oncotic pressure. Oncotic pressure is globular proteins. So since the normal composition of the fluid in Bowman space is protein-free ultrafiltrate, its oncotic pressure is negligibly small. This is at the level of the glomerular basement membrane. So the glomerular basement membrane is itself negatively charged. So in terms of things getting across, something that's negative comes up against something that's negative and gets repelled. Yeah, there's these proteoglycans, heparin, a different kind of heparin, and these are negatively charged things that supposedly keep the negatively charged stuff away. So it's the charge it's the net charge of the glomerular basement membrane, that whole process that keeps things on the one side. Yeah. So if people's blood pressure drops, you're going to waste capillary. You're not going to filter. Now this is adaptive. When you don't have enough blood pressure, you don't want that stuff going into the kidney. You don't want to be making urine when you have nothing to lose. So you want to filter less. But this would still not be good for the kidney. So it has to be fixed. You can't stay here. So physiology tries to always bring you back to here, if possible.
Low,
Yeah, auto, but right. But then if there's a place where it falls off. So as long as you can auto-regulate. But again, part of auto-regulation doesn't mean you're using the whole capillary. Not necessarily. I mean, that's the object. Use the whole capillary. But I'm just showing you the possibilities. Okay? And in this is highly schematized because you see the actual pressure in the afferent arterial and the glomerular capillary hasn't even changed. Still showing it's 50. So in real life, it would be lower. But this is just to give you an idea of how the dynamics of the forces work. Okay, so here is the regulation of GFR. Here's what you're normally supposed to have. You have two resistances. So what do you have? You have something that's supposed to flow, and you regulate the flow. If you want to regulate this pressure, you regulate the two flows on either side of it with these resistances. So this is so what would this be an example of? Increased afferent resistance. Well, that will decrease GFR and will decrease the renal blood flow. You can easily see that both of them have to go down. This is the renal blood flow, and this is the glomerular ultrafiltrate. Both of them go down when you squeeze on the afferent, and that's what NSAIDs do. If you increase the efferent resistance on this side, then even though you decrease the renal blood flow, because there's still a series resistance here, because it's on this side, the GFR goes up. So it's very important for you to look at this and realize that even though renal blood flow goes down on both of them, because of where you've done it, there's opposite effects on the GFR. Okay? And this is an example of angiotensin II. Angiotensin II maintains the efferent tone. And then you can play the game with the other ones. Prostaglandin E2 can dilate the afferent, and ACE inhibitors or ARBs can dilate the efferent. But you should be able to follow the logic here and the numbers to see that there's not a perfect, and I gave you a little in your own slide I hid, but you can play with on your own, shows you how to figure out whether something goes up or down and makes the GFR go up or down. So there's something you can play with that you have in your slide deck. But this is how, and this is what you're talking about, the autoregulation here, that over some wide range of arterial pressure, the kidney and most other important vascular beds, in this case the brain, can keep its flow constant by changing the diameter of the arterioles. So if you're supposed to keep the flow here, if blood pressure falls, then what will happen is the arterioles will dilate, and that dilatation will allow flow to be maintained. So blood pressure falls, arterioles dilate. Blood pressure increases, arterioles constrict. The whole idea is to stay here in a relative range of constant flow. Now, if pressure is too high or too low that you're on either side of this, well, then everything falls apart. Yeah. So if you're dying of shock, you're here, your GFR ain't going to be able to auto-regulate. Neither is your brain, because you're out of the range at which good physiology is possible. And you need to be resuscitated. So these are the areas of do something. Okay. Although we probably might do something here. This is where you really have to do something, because you're out of the range of you let this happen too long and the physiology is not compatible with long-term survival, which is a nice way of saying somebody's dying. Okay. But you fix it if you can. So if you look at, this is a more complex diagram that shows how over a certain range, renal blood flow and GFR are both maintained constant, and it's done that by a very complex interaction of what happens to efferent and afferent arterial tone. So what keeps the afferent arterial responding correctly to give you the right blood flow is as pressure goes up in the afferent arterial, there's something called intrinsic myogenic tone, which I'll show you, and that is what drives this resistance up. So the resistance of the afferent arterial goes up when you increase the pressure because it intrinsically knows how to do that. Okay? It's an intrinsic myogenic response of the afferent arterial. On the other hand, the efferent arterial resistance, which is shown here, that's regulated by angiotensin II. So the more the higher resistance for the afferent arterial, the efferent arterial is when angiotensin II levels go up. So it's this, you have to stare at this for a while, but it's the interplay of the afferent and efferent and the fact that they can be modified like this that allows the GFR to be maintained constant. This is called autoregulation of GFR. And it happens because you have arterioles on both sides of the glomerulus. Okay? So the way autoregulation has several components. The first component, which I mentioned, is myogenic tone. Myogenic tone is intrinsic to the arterial. You pressurize the arterial, it stretches, and then constricts against you. It knows how to constrict against that pressure, and that will maintain GFR. So if GFR tries to be, if somebody tries to increase GFR by increasing pressure, the kidney knows how to bring the GFR back down. If on the other hand pressure falls, the kidney knows how to dilate the afferent arterial and bring GFR back up. This is classic negative feedback mediated right there in with the vascular smooth muscle of the afferent arterial knows how to do this. It's called intrinsic myogenic tone. And then there's the process of tubular glomerular feedback that we're going to talk about next, which talks about how sampling the fluid at the macula densa, knowing what's going on in the tubular lumen at the macula densa, does the right thing. If it looks like the heart is trying to get away with something and causing us to waste our salt, we say, nuh-uh, and signals are sent to constrict the afferent arterial and bring down GFR. On the other hand, if it looks like there's too little salt at the macula densa, signals are brought about to do the opposite. And I'll show you a couple slides that show that. Here's the apparatus itself. Here's the glomerulus. This is the urinary pole. You know that because this is the beginning of the proximal tubule. Here's the afferent arterial. Here's the efferent arterial. And here's the macula densa. This glomerulus' own tubule that's coming up after the loop of Henle in the specialized area, shown schematically here. Same thing. Okay. So this is the JG apparatus, the urinary pole, the vascular pole. And you see that the macula densa allows there's a short distance between the tubular fluid. This is fluid in the tubule that's allowed to transduce signals across this part of the anatomy to affect what's going on with the afferent arterial. These are close together for a reason. Here's a higher power of it. Here's the glomerulus. Here's the afferent arterial. Here's the proximal tubule. And here you have, so urine would be flowing here. Here's the macula densa cells. There's the afferent arterial. So this is the signaling that's going on. Tubule, glomerular, feedback. Tubule, glomerular, feedback. At a little higher power, here's the end of the thick ascending limb is coming out at you. Here's the macula densa cells. And the macula densa cells right here have the ability you might say, how is it that the macula densa cells know what's going on here with the sodium and the chloride? Easy. That same transporter, the sodium potassium 2-chloride triple transporter that you remember from the thick ascending limb, that sits right on the apical membrane of these cells. These cells have sodium chloride sensors on them because that protein, that transporter, binds those. So this segment of tubule knows how much sodium and chloride is coming through here because it binds it. Okay, and then it tells the JG what to do, the JG apparatus. And the JG apparatus has multiple signals in it, including that's where renin is elaborated. So a lot of stuff going on in this small little area here. So the way it works is this. So here's an interesting experiment where somebody took a glomerulus. Here's the afferent arterial. Here's the efferent arterial. And what they did is they just took out an efferent arterial, and the macula densa that went along with the glomerulus. And they did a very interesting experiment. They just said, we're going to see how good this tubular feedback works. We're going to expose the macula densa to either a low sodium chloride concentration or a high sodium chloride concentration, and we're going to measure the diameter of the afferent arterial. Well, sure enough, at low levels, the afferent arterial was dilated. As soon as they increased the amount of salt, sodium chloride at the macula densa sent the signal that caused the afferent arterial to constrict. And they could just keep doing this up and down. They did it 4 times here. So every time they did it, the macula densa responded in a way that made the afferent arterial do the right thing. So over and over again, tubular glomerular feedback was induced by switching the content of the concentration of sodium chloride in the macula densa from low to high. And every time they did that, the afferent arterial responded, and it responded the way you'd want it to respond. So tubular glomerular feedback is all intact just if you pull out that little piece. That's all you need, the tubule and the glomerulus. So this is how tubular glomerular feedback works. Yeah? Yeah, so if you're saying, aren't several different possibilities exist? The answer is yes. Well, I think the first thing is to first understand how it works in the simplest way you can understand it before you can handle the more complicated case. Okay? So it is complex, but what I want you to get out of this now is that there's two kinds of signals. One very local at the afferent arteriole called myogenic tone, and one that depends on what's going out in the tubule. Okay? I want you to understand how the system is set up to work. Okay? So here's how it's set up to work. When there's an increase for tubular glomerular feedback, when there's an increase in the sodium chloride being delivered to the macula densa, that puts out a signal, an adenosine signal. That adenosine binds to an adenosine receptor on the other side and causes the afferent arteriole to constrict. It also causes a decrease in renin secretion from the kidney, and this plays into your question and is something we have to handle offline because you can't lecture about it. You have to sit down with it. But here's what I want you to get out of tubular glomerular feedback, that when it goes up, the macula densa sends out one signal that leads to constriction and decreases renin secretion. And on the other hand, when the signal goes down, a completely different signal having to do with prostaglandins is sent out that causes the opposite effect. So if you go back and forth between these two slides, the delivery, the tubule goes up, there's a constriction, and renin secretion is decreased. The signal, you flip the signal around, a different signaling molecule causes a dilation of the afferent arteriole and an increase in renin secretion, and that is overlaid on whatever happens to be going on with myogenic tone here. Okay? So a recent paper that came out that reviewed all this, okay, I read, it's a 120-page long paper. So if you want to, that's what I'm saying, if you want to get into the complexities of how these two things can interact, I have the 120-page paper that we can read together. It's fun. Okay? But it's complicated. But we're starting giving you the basic building blocks, because I'm not going to make you read the 120-page paper, because that fun we wait for later. Okay? Dessert is always later. Okay, so again, just to recapitulate, myogenic tone is intrinsic to the blood vessel, works like this. Tubular glomerular feedback is an interaction between the contents of the ions flowing in the tubule and how it affects what's going on in the afferent arteriole. And I gave you a few extra slides that are hidden that show you this process. They're in your deck, okay? So that's the end of what I want to tell you about the kidney this year. And I would say that if I would have shown you this as a first slide, you would have said, wow, we're never going to learn that. But now this slide sort of, even though it's a cartoon, it sort of makes sense. It's, oh, there's a cortex, outer medulla, inner medulla. Yeah, I understand that. Oh, yeah, look, isotonic reabsorption here. Yeah, I get that. Oh, descending limb, water comes out easily. Yeah, I get that. Oh, turn the loop. Water can't get out, okay, but salt can. Urine is very hypotonic here. Yeah, I get that. Oh, and look, there's ADH dependence over here. And look, here's even urea recycling, okay? So this should look, if you did the countercurrent module, this should look fairly friendly to you now. Okay. But it shows you how the kidney uses a tube. The kidney starts off with a tube and then says, I'm going to bend this tube into a funny shape. I'm going to make it go from different into different regions, and I'm going to endow those different regions with different properties. So I'll take the tube, and at first I'm going to do something simple in the cortex and reabsorb isotonic saline. Then I'm going to make a hairpin. That's fun. But it's going to be even more fun than that. I'm going to make the downward of the hairpin let water go out. But then the upturn, no water gets out. That's fun. And then I'll let them talk to each other a little bit. That's what the countercurrent handout talks about. Then the thick ascending loop does its thing. And that's how we get other ions across. And if you look in your deck, you'll see that there's this nice little nephron map that's basically got everything on it, including the effect of hormones. Are color-coded into this. So here's our old afferent arteriole with the JG apparatus. Here's the glomerulus. Here's the efferent arteriole coming around with the paratubular capillaries. Here's the proximal tubule, the early proximal tubule. Here's our proton secretion going on. Late proximal tubule, Lupa Henle, okay? Water impermeant. See how the water impermeant thick lines start there? Okay? So this is somebody from Colombia. And it's pretty good, pretty good. So that is the kidney. That's the kidney. There's Homer Smith. And just in the last 2 minutes, I want to show you some interesting pictures. This Homer, so this is if you go up to Bar Harbor, Maine, not far from Bar Harbor, Maine is the Mount Desert Island Biological Laboratory. We send med students there every summer. And we send them, this is the Homer Smith Laboratory. And out there is I love this. I set up a lab here in the kidney shed. The kidney shed, this doesn't look so good. Here's the other view from the kidney shed. Okay, that does look pretty good. And we do our teaching out here. And there's some very interested med students trying to figure out how we're going to do some experiments. And these particular experiments, here I am with a couple of med students from different universities all over the country. And I'm showing them how to express ENaC in frog eggs. And so here's what we did. We took frog eggs. We injected them with the RNA for ENaC so that the eggs don't know. These are beautiful oocytes. They don't know their own RNA from RNA we put in there. So it says, oh, okay, I'll make the protein. It makes the protein, it puts the ENaC on the membrane, we stick electrodes in, and basically we can measure amiloride-sensitive currents in ENaC. So you can see here's a oocyte injected with ENaC. At different voltages, we see all this current. We put on amiloride, which is known to block ENaC, and it all goes away. And everything that you see here is the subtraction. That's essentially all current going through ENaC. There's a mutation of ENaC that people have called Little syndrome. And in Little syndrome, ENaC overdoes it. It just doesn't shut off. You get gigantic ENaC currents, and those people become hypertensive. Here's an example. I have an example somewhere else. But here's what happens at night out there. So I recommend highly that people have a real lot of fun for a week doing experiments, figuring out how the kidney works, and having a great place to do it. So if you're interested, look at the ASN website, asn-online.org. Or look at the Kidney Treks program, TREKS.